From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a nationwide strike by prison inmates is on. We talk with a former inmate.
Conditions that were below government standards, poor food quality, harassment, as well as racism.
And we will hear from the State Corrections Department. Plus, can the Michigan GOP smooth over its differences heading into this weekend's convention?
The split between the governor and the wing of the party that he represents, which is kind of a more pragmatic, business-friendly Republican Party, and the wing of the party that's essentially represented by Attorney General Bill Schuette, they are not on the same page.
And best-selling mystery writer Steve Hamilton.
You know, there's something about mysteries as a reading experience that just always appealed to me. There's something very elemental about it.
Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Incarcerated Americans are on strike. A national protest by prisoners began August 21st. It runs to September 9th, which is the anniversary of the deadly uprising in 1971 at Attica Prison in upstate New York. Organizers have drawn up a list of 10 demands they say could change America's prison system for the better. Here in Michigan, there's a protest march this afternoon in Lansing. Protesters include formerly incarcerated people, anti-prison activists, and community members. They're marching to the Michigan Department of Corrections building. One of the marchers is Dennis Boatwright. He was incarcerated in Michigan for manslaughter for 24 years before he was released in 2015. He is now a business owner and a college graduate. Dennis, why are you marching today?
I'm marching to help raise public awareness on the conditions inside Michigan prison as well as around the world.
And you were in prison in this state for 24 years. Can you give us a sense what were conditions like during that time you were serving your sentence?
They were inhumane conditions. There were abuse. There were sanitary, conditions that were below government standards, poor food quality, harassment, and as well as racism.
Can you give me, when you say inhumane and abusive, can you give us some examples? Can you help us understand what you mean by that?
Well, inhumane is that prisoners were often housed in facilities that were overcrowded by any standards. Prisoners were abused because of their religious beliefs, physically abused. Some prisoners are put in solitary confinement because of their political beliefs or because they are speaking up against the conditions in prison. So they were, physically abused.
What do we know, Dennis, about what might be happening within Michigan prisons over these past few days? This national protest began August 21st. Have you gotten any indication that there are prisoners here participating in this action?
Yes. Typically, throughout the week, I would get three or four phone calls from inmates letting me know how they're doing. But this week, I haven't heard from any one of those who has been participating in the work stoppage strike in prison. So I think that there has been some retaliation going on because I haven't received any calls from the people who I normally would hear from in the Michigan Department of Correction.
Do you know categorically whether there's a work stoppage? Because the Michigan Department of Corrections indicated that there is really no one participating in work stoppages.
That could be true because there are many preemptive measures that the Michigan Department of Correction has taken. And I have told many volunteers, many good-hearted, activists, that when they're communicating with inmates inside prison, they also are telling the administration what's going on as well. So there are reports that the administration has taken preemptive strikes against inmates who they feel that may be spreading the word or who may be participating in the strike.
The demands, those 10 demands, laid out a lot about what organizers believe is not working about American prisons. And I'm wondering from your perspective, as someone who was inside for 24 years, what's a better way our society should handle folks who commit crimes?
Well, one thing we should be concerned about is the recidivism rate, because people who are sentenced to prison terms ultimately are going to come back to society. So that should be concern number one for people in societies. With that being said, there are things that statistically proves that works towards lowering the recidivism rate. And this is what all the U.S. prison system need. We need education, college courses in there, and many other classes that will help prisoners develop marketable skills. So when they return to society, they'll be able to participate in the workforce as well as pursue other goals they may have. But we need college courses in there, college classes.
You know, Dennis, as you and I talk, we would not have to look very hard to find people listening to us and who would say, look, if you're in prison, you are serving a punishment for breaking the law. You don't get to lay out a list of demands. How do you answer that point of view?
Well, whether you're in prison or not, you're supposed to be protected by the U.S. Constitution, which spells out that all humans should be created equally and as human beings. And I don't think any decent human being would go against some of the demands of prisoners, which they're not asking to come home. They're asking for better treatment. They're asking for better food quality. They're asking for the state to lower the excessive telephone rates that prisoners have to pay. They're asking that their families be able to make it easier for families to visit their loved ones who are incarcerated. These are the type of demands that I would think any decent human being would not be against.
Dennis Boatwright will be marching today in Lansing, taking part in the protest march to the Michigan Department of Corrections building in support of a national protest by prisoners. Dennis, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
With us now is Chris Gouts of the Michigan Department of Corrections. Chris, what's happening right now inside Michigan prisons? Have your wardens or correction officers reported any strike activity?
No, Michigan has not taken part in this. The prisoners there have all been reporting to work all across the state, and we've not had any issues in any of our facilities.
What is the MDOC's response to this national strike itself and the demands of the strikers?
Well, it's really hard to have a response because their message is pretty incoherent, that they don't really have a consistent message. The last list of demands I saw, I think, had 10 issues, and when you look through them, I think only three of them were something that any prison system in the country would have any say over. A lot of them were more federal issues. There weren't things that were specifically about prisoners, and certainly most of those issues don't reflect what's going on in Michigan prisons. You know, maybe there's other systems in other states that would have cause for a reason for prisoners to be upset, but that's really not what's going on in Michigan.
It certainly seems if there is one issue that these inmate protesters are really united on, it's prison labor and the feeling by some that prisoners are being exploited. Do people in Michigan prisons perform work for private companies that service customers outside of the prison walls?
No, all of the work that are done by prisoners in Michigan are done for the benefit of other prisoners around the state. So it's not done for any for-profit companies. And so I think that's where we tend to be a little different and don't tend to have the kind of issues that you see around other parts of the country. But in Michigan, we pay out about $10 million a year in prisoner wages. Obviously, people will always argue that that's not enough, but you're also going to have people that say that they'll be surprised that we even pay them at all or that we pay them, you know, that much.
One of the demands by strikers is they want more education programs and rehabilitation programs. Chris, how would you characterize the level of education and rehabilitation programs in our prisons in Michigan?
I think it's incredibly robust. We have an amazing system in Michigan. We call it the Offender Success Model, and it's been incredibly successful. We've been able to reduce our prison population by 10% over the last 3 years. We've created two vocational villages, which are one-of-a-kind in the country programs where prisoners come, apply, and move to a facility and learn in-demand trades like welding, robotics, CNC machinery. We also have community colleges and satellite campuses of several universities in our prisons where prisoners are receiving secondary education. So I think some of the national groups and some of these outside agitators that are trying to work up these prisoners around the country, obviously, I don't think have done their homework, especially when it comes to Michigan.
Chris, there was a report in Bridge Magazine that said the state puts no money toward college prison education and that the federal program that allows some inmates to take college classes is expected to run dry by 2019. Is that correct?
There is a provision in state law for now, doesn't allow funding for secondary education out of state resources. And so we do have a number of prisoners who are on a self-pay program. But we also have been very fortunate to have partnerships with institutions like Calvin College, which operates a satellite campus at one of our prisons in Ionia. And outside benefactors have paid very generously for the tuition for those students to take those classes. And then we also have had experiences with other outside organizations, the Vera Institute out of New York, which has been paid and provided scholarships for other students to take those classes through places like Jackson College. And we had a huge influx in the last year of the Obama administration. They provided the Second Chance Pell grants for the first time in, I think, several decades to allow prisoners to have access to Pell. And we are very hopeful that under the Trump administration that that will continue. And we've been making our case both at the state level and also nationally to urge that we continue that program because it's a great benefit for not only those prisoners but society itself when we can return out of prison people back into the community that have a college degree. That means they're going to be far less likely to recidivate and commit other crimes. And it's a win-win for everybody.
Are there plans in place to respond to prisoners should they join into this movement that is lasting until September 9th, until the Attica anniversary? Is there a plan in place?
Certainly, if they were to have an issue or if they were to strike or to not show up to work, certainly we would address that at the facility level. But those would be individual choices made by those prisoners. And if they chose to not work, we would then have to find somebody else to take their place. And we have many prisoners who apply for those jobs. And I think the reason why we don't see many people striking or taking part in it is because they like having that job and they earn enough of an income that they're able to do what they need to do while they're in prison. So certainly if people have issues or they join in, we would obviously address that.
Chris Gouts, Michigan Department of Corrections. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you.
Coming up next, national best-selling mystery writer and Detroit native Steve Hamilton has a new book out. We'll hear a review and then we will talk to the author. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When Steve Hamilton's first book, A Cold Day in Paradise, was published in 1998, it introduced readers to the Detroit native's sharp prose and his beloved character, Alex McKnight. The novel was awarded both the Edgar and Seamus Awards for Best First Novel, propelling Hamilton to a place among the greats of contemporary crime fiction. This week, Steve Hamilton is traveling Michigan to promote his latest book in the Alex McKnight series, Dead Man Running. Writer and Stateside contributor Keith Taylor has this review.
I know I'm one of many readers across Michigan who's very happy to see mystery writer Steve Hamilton bring back our favorite detective, Alex McKnight. This new novel is called Dead Man Running. Although this is the 11th Alex McKnight volume, it's the first one Hamilton has released in 5 years. We can all understand how a writer might want to try some new characters, some new places, some new situations. But we have missed Alex. It is very good to have him back. Alex McKnight was a Detroit cop for 8 years, but he and his partner were shot one dark night in the city. The partner died, and McKnight was forced to retire with a bullet lodged next to his heart. His wife left him. Alex was just too gloomy to live with. His vision of the world was just too dark. He retreated to a cabin in the Upper Peninsula, just outside the village of Paradise on Whitefish Bay. He is an embittered man who still seems to have some hope for the other members of his species, despite ample evidence that we are all bent on destruction. Trouble continues to find Alex. Crimes seem to find him when he sits quietly in his favorite bar in Paradise or while he is plowing out the snow on the long driveway into his cabin. Hamilton has taken his detective all across the state, and the body count has mounted from the western UP to Detroit. In Dead Man Running, we start suddenly enough in the eastern UP and end very dramatically in a small summer cottage on one of the tiny, forgettable lakes north of Grand Rapids. But along the way, we go to Arizona and New Mexico, to Texas and Ohio. Everywhere, the bodies collect. The criminal in this novel is one of the worst McKnight has had to run to ground. His crimes are gruesome and perverted in ways even Alex McKnight can barely imagine. Our detective ends up more battered and bloodied than he's been in any of the other 10 books, but he survives. Alex has to survive. Hamilton knows what he's doing. Every chapter leaves us hanging. It seems as if every page opens a new plot twist. Those who know and love Alex McKnight will be shocked where some of those twists take us. I suspect those who don't know Alex will be left breathless. Don't start Steve Hamilton's Dead Man Running in the evening, or you might lose a night's sleep. On the other hand, the fatigue tomorrow will be absolutely worth it.
That was poet and writer Keith Taylor with that review of Dead Man Running. And now we turn to mystery writer Steve Hamilton, who is back in his home state to launch this new book. Steve, welcome back to Michigan.
It's great to be here.
So you were born in Detroit, and where did you then grow up?
Born in Detroit, grew up in Dearborn for a little bit, and then we moved out to the White Lake area up in Oakland County.
And then you went to the University of Michigan?
Went to the University of Michigan. Go Blue, yes.
What was your degree in?
In computer science, of course.
Oh, interesting. Not language, not writing?
I wasn't an MFA. I wasn't an English major. This is back in the early 80s. The economy was pretty tough. And I was going to go get a good job. But I always knew, even then, that I was going to be a writer someday.
Well, I stop and I think that here this is the 20th birthday for the Alex McKnight series. This Dead Man Running is the 11th title. You have seen yourself on the New York Times bestseller list. You've won or been nominated for all kinds of awards, including you won both the Private Eye Writers of America Seamus Award and the Mystery Writers of America Edgar Award for your first book. That is great. That has to be pretty satisfying to someone who submitted a mystery story to the Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine when you were how old?
I think I was 12 years old, yeah, and I submitted a story to Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine because that was just like a dream of mine. And the nice part of that is that years later, they actually asked me to write a story for them. So
circle complete.
And I did, and it really was sort of like a Valentine to that 12-year-old me who wanted to be a writer.
Well, where did that come from? Most 12-year-olds are probably not thinking in that direction.
There's something about mysteries as a reading experience that just always appealed to me. There's something very elemental about it.
What did you read as a really little kid? When did you start reading?
I guess as long as I can remember. But
I remember the Hardy Boys.
Oh, sure, yeah. I actually did read like all of the Hardy Boys. And then I read Agatha Christie, I think, was really the one that came after that.
All right.
Her books. I just read every single one I could find.
And your little heart as a little kid said, I'm going to do
that
someday.
Exactly. So I got to be what I wanted to be when I grew up. And not many people get to say that.
How do you define a good mystery? What does it have to have in your view?
It just has to keep you... I mean, this is Ian Fleming's definition of a thriller. It's a book that makes you keep turning the pages. It's a pretty simple definition, but that's really it. For this book, they'll tell me that they read it in one night and they had to stay up all night to read it. And my first answer is, well, thanks a lot. It took me like almost a year to write it, but I did that. But my second answer to that is that's the nicest thing that you can ever say. Cause that's like the ultimate compliment for a writer is that you created this experience and this world that somebody just had to stay in until it was done.
I will tell you that I didn't know that I was in the majority like that.
Well,
I started
you,
it on Friday night and I finished it at 1:30 Saturday morning.
Thank you very much.
Well, now taking that 12-year-old who submitted a story, then the guy that took computer classes at U of M, How'd you wind up getting into that writer's niche? How many false starts and failed attempts were there?
I had plenty of false starts, and you know, every writer does. You just have to keep doing it. You have to keep doing it every day, against all odds, against all common sense. There's a million reasons not to write. It's just what I wanted to do, and I just kept doing it. And it was, even after I left college and went to work, it was a good another 8 or 10 years before I really got back to it and really remembered this is what I wanted to do. And it was a writer's group that got me sort of back into that discipline, because having those people with that external deadline just sort of waiting for you every Thursday night in the basement of that library, that's really what it took to get me back.
I have heard that from other writers.
Yeah, definitely.
That being surrounded by people who are like-minded and having that deadline
exactly
makes you jump to it. And even as Alex McKnight stories were coming out, you still had the day job.
I did, yeah. I mean, I was I worked for IBM for a long time, and actually it was a good thing because, you know, it sort of gave me that stability and that rock that I could build off of. And even when, you know, and I did 12 books while I was still working there. And in the middle of that, there was a book called The Lock Artist, which was a real departure and a real trip. And it was just like this journey to find that book. And I couldn't have taken that journey if I didn't have that other part of my life that I could sort of rely on for a while. And because that's the book that really kind of changed my life.
And that's something people can, who harbor dreams of writing, that's, I'm hoping they'll learn from the kinds of things that you've been able to do. I'm talking with Steve Hamilton, New York Times bestselling author, as we talk about his career as an award-winning mystery writer with the new Alex McKnight novel, Dead Man Running, that is now out. 20 years of Alex, who was a Detroit cop but turned his back on that life and lives in Paradise, a tiny town in the UP on the shores of Lake Superior. And Michiganders know you didn't dream it up.
That's a real town.
You have
to drive a long way to get to a blinking light up there. But I remember when we'd go up there when I was a kid. You know, everybody goes up north if you grew up in Michigan, and that might be Petoskey or Charlevoix for some people, and we go to the UP sometimes. And I remember seeing this town. It's like who lives here? And yet it was also sort of the most beautiful place, sort of the most beautiful lonely place up there, right on the lake. Whitefish Point is just north of there. That's where the Edmund Fitzgerald went down, right off the shore there. So there's a real kind of almost like a sad, forlorn atmosphere up there, but it was just something about it. It was just a very compelling place for me.
And it's given you really a chance to use it as a very skilled tool as a storyteller.
Well, setting is a big part of a story, and it makes sense for Alex in the state of mind that he was in when he left the force after seeing his partner die on the floor, you know, and not being able to stop that. He just had to go someplace that was like that. And it just felt like home to him.
Yeah, but trouble, as we learn, trouble finds
trouble
him.
Trouble finds you no matter where you go, exactly.
You know, this process of sat down thinking I'd be reading the book through the weekend and the next thing is 1:30 Saturday morning, and it took me through. It's like the tapestry that you weave of if this, then that, cause and effect threads that you are able to weave through the story, and it pulls you as a reader through, so you keep turning pages. How do you do that? Do you have kind of a roadmap in your mind, or do you sit down and let the thing tell you where it's going?
I've sort of done it both ways. The first few books I wrote, especially with Alex, I would just sort of start with an idea. It's like, what would be a really interesting problem for him to get into? What's like the worst thing that could happen to him right here, which is not fun for him, but
you're the writer, so you get
to
do that.
Exactly. It's like when I gave the commencement address at Lake State 1 year. And after that, I drove west because I hadn't been out there for a long time. And I found this place called Misery Bay. And it's just a sign, Misery Bay, 8 miles, you know. And it's like, what is this? There's got to be a great story behind a place called Misery Bay. And I drove down there and I said, okay, thank you for the next title of the next book, first of all. And then I started asking people. And everybody had a different answer for why it was called that. But as I was, you know, there at the end of that road in this place called Misery Bay, it's like, what's the worst thing that could happen right here? And then how could Alex sort of get tied up into it? And so that's really how I used to start a book. Then when I took a break a couple of years ago and wrote the Nick Mason series, mm-hmm. those are sort of tighter kind of thriller kind of books that really have to be have to come together in a little different way. So I sort of learned how to really see the whole book for the first time. You know, it took me, so that's like 12 books it took me just to learn how to outline a book, which is kind of strange. But so now that I can do that, this is really the first Alex McKnight book where I did sort of kind of see, I could see this twist being towards the end, and that's what's going to sort of drive everything.
And all those movable parts have to fit together.
It all has to fit together. Exactly. It's just
right
a big
time.
Puzzle, right?
Yes. Where do you start, Steve, when you're constructing a villain? I was thinking about that as I was reading Dead Man Running. This villain has to be believable because this is not General Zod in the Man of Steel film ranting and raving. Michael Shannon did a great job in the film. But it has to be believable. How do you approach your villains?
It has to be, you have to start with the real person. And that person's motivations have to make sense. He has to have a logical world that he lives in. And everything has to be for a reason that you can relate to, even if the effect of that is all turned inside out and totally wrong. So you really just take a... And in this case, Livermore is the really bad character in this book. It's probably the worst guy that I've ever had to be in the head of. And part of this book is really sort of told from his point of view, too, which is an extra challenge is that... Because sometimes you could see a bad guy as sort of a black box and just sort of watch what he does.
Yes.
But when you're in his head, you have to really sort of put together this person and understand what made him become this way. And it was something I wouldn't want to do a lot because it really does get to you. This guy really is a bad guy.
He is a bad guy. We're not giving any details away because you have to find it for yourself as you're reading. I saw this as I was reading Dead Man Running, thinking this is something I would watch. This is a story I watch. I was actually casting people in my head.
Right.
What about film, TV, getting your work into another medium?
We did sign a film deal for the Alex McKnight series, but,
and
there's a big but.
What's that?
In the contract, it says that if this film's going to get made, it has to get made in Michigan. So it has to be in Detroit, in Sault Ste. Marie, in Paradise, Michigan. That's where it has to be shot. Now, just a few years ago, this was a real mecca. For film and TV. Our current governor sort of took some of those incentives away.
All of them, basically.
All of them, okay, all of them, thank you.
He ran on that promise.
He kind of did. I go way back with our governor. We went to school together, and we lived in the same dorm together. So I've known him for a long time, and we obviously don't agree on this, because there was value to having Detroit be the place to make a movie. Aside from just if there was financial benefits, which maybe came about, which maybe weren't all that they were promised or not, but it just having Detroit be back. There was this intangible thing about Detroit and Michigan. It's like, that's where you go to make a movie. And when he turned that switch off, and I've been to Hollywood and I've talked to people, they said it was night and day. We're not going to ever go back to Michigan. So I'm just trying to maybe turn that around a little bit, because this will be a big film, and it'll get made right here in Michigan.
So this is the deal, but there's a lot of stirring of the pot to make this all happen, isn't there?
We'll see. We're going to find out. But, you know, if somebody really wants to make this movie, and I think we'll get there, it'll just be the absolute blast of a lifetime to come back here and watch some film in Detroit again. And go up north and see what up north really is like, because they've done up north Michigan a couple times in movies, and they don't get it right.
You want it right.
Yeah, exactly.
Steve is going all around Michigan launching Dead Man Running. In fact, you always launch your books back in your home state.
I always come back. This is book number 14.
Yeah,
and this is where I come from. And this is where, especially with Alex, this is where he comes from.
Yes,
so that first book, it's been 20 years. It's hard to imagine.
Yeah.
I started here with that first book and every book since.
Well, there is a long list. He is all over the state, busy, busy. Lots of locations now through August 26th. And you can find them all because we have a link to Steve's website that we have at the stateside page at michiganradio.org. Steve Hamilton, author of Dead Man Running, thanks so much.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Whether you've got Michigan's arts and cultural stories on your mind or anything else related to our state, we always want to hear from you. What Michigan issues or people do you want to hear more about? Let us know. Find us on Facebook. Just search for Michigan Radio. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And you can always find us by going to MichiganRadio.org and click the link that says Stateside. Up, it looks like Aretha Franklin may have died without leaving behind a will. And that raises the question, just how important is it to think about estate planning and talk with your family?
If you communicate clearly with everyone in your family and everyone in your life about what your estate plan is, you are reducing the odds that there will be a fight after you die.
That's in about 5 minutes. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. Welcome back. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan Republicans will gather at their convention this weekend to line up their ticket for November, led by gubernatorial candidate Bill Schuette. But one prominent member of the party will not be there, Governor Snyder. His office says a scheduling conflict will keep him from being at the final convention of his time in office. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here with us. And Daniel, your column today focuses on the underlying cracks behind the Michigan GOP's public message of unity. What is your take on the governor's scheduling conflict?
The old scheduling conflict dodge is what I think. I don't buy it, although, frankly, there could be a scheduling issue. But if it was important for him to be there, he would make an exception. Look, this is just more of the same. The split between the governor and the wing of the party that he represents, which is kind of a more pragmatic, business-friendly Republican Party, and the wing of the party that's essentially represented by Attorney General Bill Schuette, they are not on the same page. And then you add the Flint investigation that this attorney general is spearheading. And I think that the people in the Snyder camp and a lot of the supporters think that it is aimed squarely at the governor. The fact that they have now bound over for trial Nick Lyon is not sitting well with the Snyder folks for reasons that I think should be very obvious to anybody. You know, he's one step away from essentially from the governor.
In fact, I have to ask you, because I'm looking at this line in your column, Schuette's continuing Flint investigation, maybe potentially eyeing Snyder himself?
Yeah, I think a lot of people think that this is an attempt to squeeze Nick Lyon to potentially get additional testimony or evidence or a different recollection or whatever the case may be against the governor. Now, I think you have to put this in the context of this campaign for governor. If the attorney general and his people politically believe that that might be advantageous, do they push ahead with it? They might, but they're going to have the evidence to justify it. Mm-hmm. If, on the other hand, there is evidence that it could cost politically, you know, soften support among, say, the business community, I think the attorney general and his people might think twice about pursuing this. There is a political component here. And the other political component that I think is very interesting is the whole Trump effect. I
mean, absolutely.
Bill Schuette has said, I'm a Trump guy. I have one of his most trusted senior advisors on record in the column today saying he's rock solid for the president. That's fine. The president is going through some rather difficult political times right now. And he has yoked himself to Donald Trump. Does that help him? It might help him with some basis of the party. But as somebody pointed out to me, you know, successful candidates for governor in Michigan have built one of two things. Democrats have built a center-left coalition, and Republicans have built a center-right coalition. And the question is whether the center of voters who might be predisposed to vote for the right kind of Republican would want to do that if the candidate is so yoked to Donald Trump. And I don't think we know the answer to that yet.
And as you write in your piece today, we have had, I'll quote you, 8 years of comparatively non-ideological governance, or as our It's Just Politics team of Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta often say, politics is not Rick Snyder's jam. What does Michigan need from its next crop of leaders?
Well, I think they need a lot of more of the same. I think one of the reasons Michigan has been as successful as it has in this national economic expansion has been the kind of leadership Governor Snyder and Mayor Mike Duggan and Warren Evans in Wayne County. I mean, you can go down the list of people who are much less partisan than their predecessors. One of the fears that I have, and I'm not alone, is that we may be moving back to a more ideological governorship. Whether it's Bill Schuette or whether it's Gretchen Whitmer. These are people that have their bases. They clearly are appealing to their bases. Look at who they both picked for lieutenant governor candidates, mm-hmm. which suggests that they may not have the greatest appeal, the center-right, center-left appeal. But I think more of the same is going to be more important than going back to a more ideological situation where whoever gets in that office starts to undo things. And I'm hearing people make arguments that they think either candidate who is successful will start to unwind certain Snyder accomplishments, whether it's the Gordie Howe Bridge, whether it's certain things in cooperation with the city of Detroit, which has been very good in what netted the bankruptcy in ways that a lot of people thought would never happen, a consensual resolution to what a lot of people thought would be a many years fraught, protracted legal fight.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel House. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
Aretha Franklin reportedly died without leaving behind a will or a trust. Her four sons are expected to split her estate, but any questions about who else has a claim on that estate will be thrashed out in the public setting of Oakland County Probate Court. Franklin joins a long list of celebrities who did not have a will: Prince, Heath Ledger, Amy Winehouse, Dr. Martin Luther King, Marvin Gaye, and many more. If you die intestate without a will, the state and its courts handle your estate. So let us talk now about estate planning. And with us is Julia Bellion. She's an associate professor at Detroit Mercy Law, where she teaches property law and estates and trust. It is good to have you with us, Julia.
I'm glad to be here.
Court records appear to show that Aretha Franklin left no will or trust. So I wanted to start with the difference between a will and a trust. What are those?
Well, one of the most important distinctions for purposes of the issue of whether she left a will or trust is that ordinarily documents used to create a trust or administer a trust do not have to be filed with a court. And so it is quite possible that there is one or more trusts out there or other estate planning device that doesn't require any kind of court filing. Having a will or not having a will is indicative of some things, but it's generally irrelevant to the question of whether you have some estate planning.
Okay, so not having a will does not equal not having an estate plan.
Precisely.
Help us understand that, because I think to us civilians, if you don't have a will, you don't have an estate plan.
Well, and some people, the misunderstanding even goes deeper. They fear they don't have an estate or something that fundamental. But an estate is just another way of talking about your physical holdings in the world, which include assets as well as liabilities. You have an estate. I have an estate. Everybody listening to this has an estate. Even everybody not listening to this has an estate. But we're living people, and so it's no big deal to administer that estate because it's ours and we do it.
Mm-hmm.
At our death, someone else has to administer our estate at least long enough to get the title in all of our property transferred to whomever has the right to receive that title. So there are many ways of transferring property at death, just like there are many ways of transferring property during life. For example, if you have assets held in any sort of account, a bank account, brokerage account, that sort of thing, the odds are very high that you already have completed a form with the bank that states whom you wish to be the owner of the account once you die. Because that's in the nature of contract law, it's not a probate issue. It's an agreement you entered into with the financial institution where the account is located, and they're bound to follow the contract. And that has nothing to do with the probate court.
So that sounds like it's pretty buttoned down when you filled out that form saying, you know, in the event of my death, let it go to my spouse, let it go to my child. That's pretty buttoned down.
Right, because that's all the property that you have that is managed by a contractual agreement with a third party. That will include bank accounts, life insurance agreements, all kinds of things that are the way most people, retirement accounts also. Most people's wealth in America today is bound up in and managed according to contractual agreements with financial institutions.
All right. So what's left outside of that that could cause trouble?
So outside of that, any property that is not governed by contract is then going to be part of the individual's estate when they die, and that is what the probate court has jurisdiction over. Now, a trust is itself a contractual agreement, and that's why, although trusts typically are used to ensure the orderly transmission of property at death, first of all, that's not their only use, but secondly, because they are in the nature of a contractual agreement, they don't have to go to the probate court. What is left is anything that is not passing according to one of those other means, and that includes everything that you just own in your own name. That's pretty much it. Things that you own as a co-owner, your interest still might pass, or it may be that your interest simply ceases to continue to exist once you die. For example, if you own property as a joint tenant, then the other joint tenant, if it is with a right of survivorship, will own the property outright, doesn't require any paperwork, doesn't require a probate court. So we're left with those things like whatever you own in your own name outright.
So just so I'm clear, let's say that for my husband and myself, if we have not filed papers, we don't have a will in place, I'm just saying if, and he dies,
mm-hmm.
there's no question that the house and things he signed will go to me?
If the paperwork is done correctly and it is in fact that the house is held either as tenants by the entirety or as joint tenants, that's where people, I think, can get confused because people may think they hold property in certain ways, and the paperwork may reveal that they don't. Mm. That's why talking to a lawyer might be helpful, just to be sure that you understand correctly what you own and how you own it. But if we assume that everything you've said is correct, that it's actually held as a joint tenancy or a tenancy by the entireties, and all other assets are held in means that either you're the co-owner or there's a beneficiary designation with a financial institution, then there will be virtually no estate to probate.
I'm going to call this the ugly surprise department.
Yes, ma'am.
What are some examples that really stick in your mind of things that happen in a family when there is not estate planning that's been done, there's no will set up, there's no trust set up? What can happen?
Well, I will begin by saying that there is only one absolutely secure method of estate planning, and that is to give it all away before you die. That is the only way to ensure that there won't be any fight over who gets what after you die. Secondly...
Yeah, fair enough, barring most of us not doing that.
Right. Well, you know, it's always a trick of timing because you don't want to give it away too soon before you die.
Exactly. Timing is very important.
Yes.
So let's say you don't do that. So
right.
That one's so, off the table. Then what?
Not doing that, then the second thing that I would identify as a risk factor is whether you have communicated frequently and clearly with all of your family members either about what your estate plan is or what your wishes are. Even if you have an estate plan, that doesn't stop the fighting. People fight when they're surprised. You called it the ugly surprise, and that's it exactly. People tend to be more interested in litigating an estate when what they see happening is not what they expected. So if you communicate clearly with everyone in your family and everyone in your life about what your estate plan is, you are reducing the odds that there will be a fight after you die. You might not be reducing the odds of a fight, but you're going to have it now instead of them having it after you're dead.
And when you think of perhaps things you've seen in your practice and your teaching, mm-hmm. give us a for instance. Don't have to name names.
Oh, easy to do. Another thing I have noticed, I've never read about this anywhere, it's just something I've personally observed, siblings tend to revert to the way they related the last time they all lived together whenever a shared parent dies.
Mm.
So if you left home when you were 16, and if I were your little sister and I was 13 when you left home to go to college or whatever, then when we get back together, especially if our mutual parent has died, we're going to interact just like we did when we were 16 and 13. So there's a tendency for people to behave badly just because of the stress of grief and the stress of the loss of someone as crucial as a parent. At that point, whatever unresolved issues they have with either the deceased parent or any of the surviving members of the family, that stuff tends to come out at that point. And so, you know, happy people have fewer estate squabbles. Unhappy families have significant estate squabbles, and they can range from bickering over billions of dollars to in an estate worth $1 billion arguing about who gets the Rolex watch.
Mm.
It is emotion. There's so much emotion involved in it. It's one of the reasons I love this area of law. It is highly specific and demanding in terms of the technical aspects, taxes and all the different planning vehicles that you can use. But at the end of the day, it's about human beings and their emotional relationships with each other, with the things that they own, and with the fact of their own mortality.
So your advice based on seeing these human emotions burst forth, let's say parents are, you know, they have adult kids and no one has really talked about what happens when mom and dad go.
Right.
Do's and don'ts.
Well, I would suggest that it would be best if the parents are the ones who bring it up. I can tell you, because I've had to do this myself, there's nothing quite as awkward as asking your own parents whether they've done their estate planning. It just sounds funny, especially over Thanksgiving dinner. So if you are the parents, talk to your kids. Tell them what you have planned. Tell them where they can find the important documents. And make sure that each of them, to the best of your ability, understands why you plan to do what you plan to do with what you own. Secondarily, if you're a child, at some point, it doesn't even matter, because even if you ask, they could tell you something that isn't true. If you feel terribly awkward asking, then I don't know how much you're going to gain by asking. But the main thing is, to the extent that you're comfortable with whoever you're worried about, just ask them, talk to them. Do you have a will? Where will it be if I need to find it? And then when they get all freaked out, you just say, I'm not going to kill you. I just want to know where to find the papers. Because these days, that's really one of the biggest chores is just figuring out where to find all the documentation.
Very much so. Julia, what have you found in your years of watching and working with families? What are reasons that people just don't get around to it?
There are a lot of different reasons, but I think the primary, number one, most common, nearly universal reason is that really taking a good, hard look at what you own and how you want it to be handled after your death requires that you become at least somewhat comfortable with the fact of your own mortality. And that is something that is a pretty big existential challenge, and a lot of people really would prefer not to think about it. And who can really blame them?
Yeah.
Second, and related to that, is the idea that there's always more time. So it's uncomfortable today. Perhaps I will feel better about it tomorrow. I'll put it off. A third possibility is that sometimes people misunderstand. They believe that doing estate planning somehow reduces the amount of control they have over their own property for the rest of their life. And that doesn't have to be true. In fact, it usually is not true. Another reason that people sometimes put it off, this is definitely not a majority reason, but it indicates the sort of family dynamics that it can predict trouble. Some people deliberately delay doing estate planning because they are using that open question as a method of manipulating people in their lives. You know, if you don't do this, I'll leave it all to so-and-so.
You've seen it all, haven't you?
Oh, I've probably seen even more than that, but I believe I've seen people who have left limited or no instructions purely to create hardship for their family. I mean, on purpose to sow that kind of discord. It's regrettable, but it's sort of the last act that you have is the transfer of your property at your death. And some people really want to do special things with that. For good or ill.
It is interesting. I wonder if this new attention on Aretha Franklin and her sons making this estate filing, and now we're hearing, for example, with Prince, that has become quite the issue. Michael Jackson's estate is fighting the IRS all these years after. I wonder if it will start putting a thought bubble in people's minds. Maybe we need to get going and tackle this.
It might, but I think a lot of people also, this is probably really the second most common reason, they believe they don't own enough to make it worth the trouble. They don't have $80 million in assets like Aretha Franklin may have. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, yes, that's true for those people, but not necessarily true for me. And I believe my own father thought this way until the day came that I said, well, you know, this includes things like, and I started listing every kind of asset that one could reasonably expect a man of his age and class to own. And I was only about two-thirds of the way through the list, and he said, oh, I guess I hadn't thought about all that stuff. So some of us own more than we think we do. It's just not in our pockets, so we don't think about it.
I can absolutely see why you find this a very, very interesting and challenging area of law. Julia Bellion is an associate professor at Detroit Mercy Law. She teaches property law and estates and trusts. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.